Good. Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Public Sustainability Week. My name is Gabrielle Spilker. I'm a professor of international politics, global inequality here at the University of Konstanz. I assume half of the room is part of my seminar, International Politics, and the other half of the room is not. So welcome to both groups. The one half needs to be here, although they would, of course, otherwise also have shown up clearly. And the other half, who just came because it's part of the Public Sustainability Week, came entirely voluntarily here. Cool. Welcome to both groups. Happy to see you. What I would like to do in my 60 minutes is at least two things. The first is to give you an answer to the first question you see here. And I spent about like half an hour, maybe 40 minutes to discuss this with you. Why, if you have to come up potentially with the worst problem ever, you might come up with climate change. Why this is really such a wicked, we often say, problem, and why it has so many dimensions that makes it so hard to find political solutions for this. And this is really, if I succeed in this, this is already one good thing. The other goal for me today is to give you an answer to the last question written here. The two questions in between are for my seminar. It's like really steps in between, like trying to see a bit like what you read and what you how you thought about the readings for today. And the second goal is really to illustrate you why from an international politics perspective, and this is like a lecture in the context of international politics, why this Paris Agreement is really so weird. And it is weird. It's super weird. And I really want to illustrate you why this is the case, why we have ended there, so to say. We have not ended, but I mean, why this is where we are currently there, what the history of international climate cooperation is, and why there was potentially no better way to do things than this. But just that we, at the end of the day, go out of here and really understand why this is really such a special case compared to anything else what we see. So that's my plan for today. Let's see how far we get. I love to start talking about climate change with this little short story because I think it illustrates it so nicely. This is a short story about four people. Everybody, somebody, anybody, and nobody. There was an important job to be done, and everybody was asked to do it. Everybody was sure somebody would do it. Anybody could have done it, but nobody did it. Somebody got angry about that because it was everybody's job. Everybody thought anybody could do it, but nobody realized that everybody wouldn't do it. It ended up that everybody blamed somebody when actually nobody asked anybody. And to me, this is really illustrating nicely, though also sadly, the state we are in, just to set the stage. And I give you a bit of a word of warning. The next 60 minutes are a bit, not traumatic, but at least pessimistic. It's not the seminar of good news. I have a cartoon at the very end that might cheer you up again. So just to set the stage that in now from now on it goes downhill, and at the end I try to lift you up with one tiny little cartoon, so to say. Okay, just to very briefly, I suppose everybody knows it, but just to very briefly, if you had to explain to my son or to Frank's son what is climate change, how would you do that? Anyone? What is it, what we're talking about? This is super, I had this exact same seminar 2 hours ago, and we have that twice, and it's as if you had been there and known what the others have said. That's exactly the same. This is absolutely not wrong, but it's not as abstract as you might wanna go in terms of, we are thinking about climate change the way it happens right now, but it could also be something it could materialize itself differently. And what we want for a pure definition is something that captures it all. And this is the definition that the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, German Weltklimarat, gives in its fourth assessment report on climate change. And the interesting part is really the one in green, as you might have guessed. It's like it can be identified, but it changes in the mean and or the variability of its properties. So what are the properties of climate? Temperature would be one, definitely, but also precipitation would be another. And this is where the variability becomes much more interesting. So the mean, if we think about climate change, if we just jump here, often we see these kind of diagrams if you want to illustrate what climate change is or something like this, right? This would be like the mean in temperature. But we might also be interested in, for which I don't have a picture right now with me, it's like the variability in its properties and the variability, for instance, in precipitation, which is often very important for people if rain is much more extreme suddenly. If we have massive amounts of rain more, or it comes at different points in time, so it might not be the level itself, but it might be the variation in it that might matter for people more. And both of these, taken over the long run, are indicators of climate change. I jumped over this one here. I don't want to go much into detail or not at all here. This is just for everyone in the seminar, just as a backup slide that you realize what the problem really is. Two words about what causes this greenhouse effect. And if from a political science perspective, we think about mainly one, sometimes two greenhouse gases that are relevant for us when we think about political responses to the problem. These are CO2 emissions and methane emissions. The latter is the more potent greenhouse gas in the sense that it has a bigger impact on the greenhouse, on the problem of climate change, but it's much more short-lived in its duration. For us political scientists, we are sometimes a bit opportunistic. I mean, not sometimes, we are, I guess, all the time very opportunistic. And we are often not paying too much attention to things that we find politically not interesting. And methane is one of those issues. This is something that is a big headache for the problem, of course. It's something that they will next week again try to get more countries on board in the club of voluntarily reducing methane emissions and so on. But this is, from a political perspective, more a problem of capacity issues, of really closing leaks in oil pipelines, of really getting a lot of firms to capture methane when they flare natural gas and the like. So this is something from a political perspective that is not really interesting because there's not that much bargaining about this. There's not that much political action around this that we can explain and that we find interesting. This is very different for CO2 emissions. So for the rest of the talk by now, when I talk about climate policies and the like, what I really mean are policies that mostly in one way or the other capture CO2 emissions or intend to reduce our CO2 emissions. So, the consequences of climate change, you all know, from global heating to sea level rise and so on and so forth. What is potentially, this is already very worrying. What is also very worrying, maybe harder to grasp, is the issue of tipping points. Has anyone heard about that? Exactly. So the tipping point is something where, from a purely analytical perspective, it just describes a phenomenon where a system of what sort ever flips or changes to a new state of things and we can't reverse it. This can be a social system too. If you think about horse carts, for instance, there once was a world when people drove around with horse carts and then technological progress happened and the automobile came. And at one point there was this tipping point where suddenly it was clear, okay, we won't go back to a state where people drive around using horse carts, except for fun in the winter when they find this nice or something. But mostly we think about this in natural science terms. And here this phenomenon means this point in time where we can't go back, where, for instance, we lose the Arctic sea ice and the like, and this is something then it's irreplaceable, which has consequences down the line, which natural scientists try to model and try to understand, but which evolve a lot of uncertainty, and we might not know now what the entire consequences of this is, other than very likely they are not good. But now, that's just a bit of background for you, just to what we are talking about, what climate change is, what the problem is. Now we move over to the world of first environmental politics, and later on then to international climate politics. And what I would like to do for the next maybe 10 minutes or so is to explain you a little bit, and that might be dull in some sense, giving you a theoretical framework of how we think about environmental problems if we are coming from an environmental politics background. And now you can say, why is that important? Why do we need to go to this dull things? I would argue because of three reasons. One is we need to understand how environmental problems arise in order to understand why some find an easy, more or less easy, international or domestic politics solution than others. Because if we understand the incentives of actors involved, both those who create the problem and those who suffer from it, we can better understand when and under what circumstances we get a solution. And we also need to understand how much this is really a problem of technological change, capacity, how much power has to do with this, a lot. Knowledge and so on and so forth. So this is really the reason why I just want to torture you for the next 10 minutes with a few of these things. And there are two important ways for me to think about environmental problems more generally, and therefore also about climate change. And the first difference, how one can map this world of environmental issues or problems, is how does the problem arise in the first place? In what way do people obtain utility, be it positive or negative, from a specific environmental resource? How can that happen? And here we can distinguish between three differences. The first two I will explain in more detail the next minute. The third one is just here for completeness sake. It's not relevant for us later on. And mainly we can distinguish between problems that arise because we want to use the resource as such. Think about the forest, the lumber. We cut down the forest in order to use the wood, the lumber, for a purpose. And if we do that too much, we create an environmental problem. Same with fish and the like. Or if we do something like driving around in cars, producing stuff in companies and the like. And here it's not the natural resource as such that creates the problem, but rather it's an indirect externality. And then we could also have utility from an environmental resource just by knowing that it's there. Think about the polar bears, the pandas, and the like. This is just here for completeness sake. It's not as, again, that's the opportunistic part of the political science perspective. That's not interesting to model for us too much. The second difference is the one that for political reasons or for political science reasons is much more interesting. And this is, what types of incentives have those who create the problem and who suffer from this? And this is really the question, how much are certain actors involved in that, perpetrators or victims, and how much is the problem really a problem of capacity? More on this right now. Difference one. We can think about environmental problems, as I said before, because we use a certain resource too much. Here it's really the resource itself that provides utility, and the only way really to save the resource or to change the problem is by changing the activity, the scope of the activity itself, by changing the quantity. Think about the tuna fish. It doesn't help the tuna fish if you catch it via one net or another. The tuna is gone. And we have to, if we want to keep the tuna stock at a specific level, we just have to reduce the quantity of tuna we take out of the sea in order to have the tuna stock at a specific level, right? It doesn't matter how we take it out. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to say like, hey, you can torture tuna. Not at all. But for solving the problem of having enough tuna in the sea, it doesn't matter how you take out the tuna. The important thing is the quantity. This is different, and this becomes important later on, for problems of degradation. Here it's not that we damage the resource because we want to consume the specific resource. No one wants to consume CO2, typically not. CO2 is not the issue itself. It's a byproduct of stuff we do. And it means we decrease the quality of typically another resource. You can think about air pollution, water pollution, and the like. So it's a byproduct, and we degrade another resource. It's often unintended. Typically, it's unintended. No one has any utility really of putting CO2 out somewhere. The interesting part for us is that this can be changed in two ways, right? We could change the quantity of CO2 that we pull out either by doing less of the activity itself. We could just don't drive around with cars anymore. But we could also achieve the same thing by using a different technology. We could use an electric car that runs on solar power. Right? So this is different to the first issue, where it's really only the quantity of the action itself that needs to change. Here we have two options: reduce the quantity, or the way we do it, or both. Climate change falls in this category. So that's one difference that is interesting for us. I just jump over here because that's also only for completeness sake in there and not really important for us. What becomes really important for us, and this is where climate change is so different to most, if not any other environmental problem, and this is really the incentive structures of actors involved. Many of you have heard of this phenomenon, the tragedy of the commons, I assume. The typical example of the tragedy of the commons is something that is called Almende. This is this grazing ground in former times that many villages had, where they had one common grazing ground where everyone was allowed to put his or her sheep, cattle, whatever they had, on the grazing ground. And the problem simply arose that if this is common property, everyone who lives in the village has an incentive to put as many of his or her cattle, sheep, whatever, on the grazing ground, just to increase his or her utility from the grazing ground and getting most out of it. The problem is, if everyone does that, the Almende dies, right? It's like overused. What do we need to do? In a village, this is not that complicated. Eleanor Ostrom, a Nobel Prize winning political scientist / economist, fantastic woman who unfortunately is no longer with us. She won the Nobel Prize, among others, exactly on issues of how to solve the strategy of the commons problems, by either having institutions where you have a mayor in the village that hands out rights, or in a village, it's often enough if you talk to each other, if people have enough trust among each other, really have rules on who can use it when and why, which is easily doable on the village level. It's also often, or not often, it's also in a functioning state possible and happens, or is typically the case, that these issues are solved because we have a government who can enforce who has which rights of the resource and don't have it as a common pool resource, so to say, but one with clearly defined property rights. So, enter the international level. We don't any longer have a government or a world police or anything. We have just actors, states, who all have the same incentive structures, and they have, if they want to have an agreement, it kind of needs to be self-enforcing, because we don't have an entity on top who can enforce that. Sometimes the workaround is, if we, and that has worked, for instance, for the so-called Montreal Protocol, with that was there to, or that countries negotiated to get rid of the problem of ozone depletion. If we have the one state that is powerful enough, typically that was the United States, interested in the problem and really interested in solving this, which was the case for ozone depletion, and if a powerful country really is behind an international regime and wants to enforce it, then we have via the power route a way out. Sometimes we have, this is the case for trade, which the others in the seminar, those who are in the seminar will learn about in January or February. There we have this idea of tit for tat, reciprocity, where countries can use the threat of increasing tariffs if the other country doesn't stick to the rules. But that doesn't work for climate change for various reasons. So we have this tragedy of the commons problem. But is climate change really only a tragedy of the commons problem? There is another way of thinking about environmental problems, and this is these are so-called upstream downstream problems, where we have a clear differentiation between those who cause the problem and those who are the victims. Typically, we think about rivers, and you might want to think about, let's imagine there's a country that has a huge pharmaceutical industry, and this pharmaceutical industry happens to be very accidentally at the bordering town of a major river somewhere, and then all the pollution just goes to the downstream countries. So you might want to look a bit in this direction. You might see some of these phenomena. So these issues exist. They don't only exist on rivers, where the name really comes from, upstream, downstream. There was in the 1980s this phenomenon of acid rain and dying forests because of this. This was caused by sulfur dioxide emissions, SO2 emissions, that used to come a lot from burning sulfur-containing coal. And one way, there was an interesting upstream downstream problem if we look at the UK back then, and mainly Sweden, because the winds in the area between the UK and Sweden were as such that if you just put emissions high enough into the air, they would travel because of the winds to Sweden. And so what many UK firms did was they built the smoke scraps on their firms high enough to put the pollution out there, and then it traveled to Sweden, and they could, once they had the technology, they could really see where the pollution came from. They had these pollution matrices where we had this clearly upstream downstream problem also with air pollution. So thinking now, moving back to climate change, how is climate change also an upstream downstream problem? Or is it? Yeah. Absolutely. I would say not necessarily, but absolutely not. If you think about the small island states, but also if you think about the example of Pakistan, where we really had this issue of these big floods, and where they in the aftermath said, like, hey, this is such an unfair situation. We have contributed so little to this huge problem, and we are suffering so much of it. And then add the power differential, and this is something where I cannot stress enough how wicked the issue of climate change really is, because those who created the problem are not only those who suffer less from the issue than those who didn't create the problem. Also, those who suffer and haven't created, those are the ones least powerful in the international system. So they have really the least options to force a better bargain that the problem is solved. Couldn't be much worse. But just, I make it worse, okay? Just you have to bear with me for a few more of those things. It's also, in some sense, an incapacity problem. So incapacity problems more generally result from us having, or whoever is the relevant actor, not having either the administrative, the technical, or the financial means to solve this issue. And this is, of course, also true for climate change. And the later we will hear a presentation about adaptation aid and the question whether, so there is this differentiation between mitigation in climate change terms and adaptation. Mitigation means we have to invest in ways to reduce the problem, to reduce emissions, invest in renewable energies, for instance. Adaptation means we also need to invest in measures that allow us to live with the consequences that are already materializing. And this is, of course, a big issue, especially for those countries here, the downstream countries that already face today these issues and therefore need a lot of resources, financial resources, technological resources, administrative resources to deal with this issue, where the issue of adaptation aid comes in, where we later on hear a presentation about this. To summarize, what does that mean for climate change? For one, it happens as a problem of so-called degradation. It's an unintended byproduct, but importantly, not by one activity, but by a lot of activities, which I will show you in a minute, which makes it even more complicated. And then it's everything. It's not only a tragedy of the commons problem, as it was for long portrayed, but it's also an upstream downstream problem and an incapacity problem, and one where the power structure above all is as unfortunate as it could be. That's not enough for the bad news, I'm afraid, sorry. I said this is not good for the comic, the cartoon will come. Just to show you a bit, as some of you might know, I'm a professor of global inequalities, and I just want to highlight for the next 4 minutes or so a bit more, because that's important for later on how the international cooperation issue has evolved, is the question of who causes how much of the problem and how the inequalities play in here and why we ended up with both the mess in terms of climate change, but also the interesting cooperation arrangements we have. What this graph illustrates, it illustrates a lot of things, but for me what is important is that for a long time the problem has been caused mainly by the United States and Europe, which reflected, and you will see that later on, in something called common but differentiated responsibilities that were laid down in the first big international treaty to solve this issue, the UNFCCC, the United Nations Framework on Climate Change. And this common but differentiated responsibilities acknowledges just this very fact, that there are some actors that are more responsible for this issue than others. And that's clearly the fact. Then something has happened that no one estimated it would happen that fast. And this is that the red guys over there grew so immensely in their emissions. And the first protocol to deal with the issue of climate change, the so-called Kyoto Protocol, you will see that later, had only so-called emission reduction targets for industrialized countries in it. And it was intended right from the beginning to only last for 2 periods. And it was clear this is a first step, so the international community always saw it as a first step, we negotiate that. And then later on we make a bigger agreement with more emission reductions and covering more countries. But that wasn't easy. And they thought like, hey, we have a bit more time, but then India and China really took off. And then it was clear that any agreement that doesn't cover these 2 countries, it won't solve the issue. Very straightforward. However, that still means they have historically seen much less of a responsibility. Furthermore, it gets more complicated. If you look at this, this is emissions per capita. This is just absolute emissions, right? How much each country, but these are very different entities, right? And if we think about how much each person in China versus India is even more drastic, emits, we have a really big inequality imbalance. By the way, anyone knows who is the biggest emitter per capita wise? Yeah, Emirates, but all bad. Yeah. I make it even worse, okay? Do these per capita emissions, they are measured as those emissions that arise in a country simply divided by its population. That's the way the international system decided in the early 90s that this is a good way of measuring this. After all, this is the emissions arising in this country. Does that mean that these emissions belong to these people? No, maybe, but maybe not. Why not? Because over the last 20 years, China has become, among others, the power of one of those countries where a lot of very CO2 intensive products have been produced. But they are not produced for, I mean, they're also produced for the Chinese population, but mainly they go somewhere else, to the US, to Europe. So in some sense, these emissions here are also our emissions, huh? Troublesome. It makes it even worse, and it makes it even more, and this all just illustrates, hey, we need to solve this issue, because if we don't include China and India, we don't solve it. But the inequality aspect, seen both historically but also per capita wise and the like, really difficult. That's just another one to illustrate the upstream downstream issues. And I want to illustrate two more inequalities here. One is that what we see here is just that both climate related disaster losses per country group is much bigger in the low income part, and it also affects more people there. Yet, and here comes another inequality. This is seen internationally. So we have this upstream downstream problem internationally, but we also have it within most societies. There is a lot of research that shows us this, that across the globe, but also within countries, it's the rich that really emit much more. And some of you might remember we had some interesting discussions a few weeks ago about this. But, and also if we see, I mean, often one argument against the graph on the left is, but of course they emit more, but there are also very fewer people, so it doesn't matter. It matters, clearly. And this comes against the background of a lot of the consequences also having very unequal impacts. There is some fantastic, in terms of research-wise, fantastic, but really horrible outcome-wise articles that show that, for instance, tropical cyclones affect the poor much more than the rich. It's the same with heat waves and other instances of climate disasters. Why? Because many of the poorer people have less abilities to adapt. They have often less access to early warning systems. If you think about Florida, when the flooding comes, when can people leave? Can they simply leave their home? I mean, they might be afraid of leaving their houses completely because other people may come in and take away their stuff and the like. But also, if you think about Constance is this happy island anyways, but if you think about bigger cities, Berlin and the like, if you look at green spaces, where are these green spaces? Are they in those parts of the city where a lot of poor people live, where they have enough ways to adapt and the like? And this is really where also for us this inequality part, both in adaptation, and it also comes in with mitigation. We might have not time to talk about this, but yeah. So this is really something that is where these inequalities make climate change even worse. And then one more slide, and then I have to hurry up to talk about in the international cooperation part. This is just to illustrate where greenhouse gas emissions come from. Biggest sector is electricity, followed by transport, followed by manufacturing, agriculture. Why is this important? Because of two reasons. And this is where I hopefully hammer home the point that climate change is really a wicked problem, right? So this problem arises because of almost anything we do, right? It arises because the way we live, the way we travel, the way we eat, whatever. From a political science perspective, this has a really important implication. For one, we need many different technologies, but also climate change is not simply environmental politics. Maybe it's not environmental politics at all. It's energy politics, it's transport politics, it's housing politics, it's agricultural politics, it's everything, so to say. And it has huge distributional consequences. There are, for all these types of policies, there are winners and losers attached, which might just dislike the type of policy. We have seen this all play out nicely with the heating law in the German context, right? And this is makes it from a, it's not just simply, hey, we have to, I mean, Frank might disagree in some sense. He might just say like, hey, just have a CO2 price for everything and it will work out. But I mean, we really need a lot of policies to tackle that. And that means it's just not one ministry that will take it on, but it's really an encompassing issue, making it really troublesome, right? And then we have all these inequalities. Boof. Woof. Okay. I think for the time being, that's enough of bad news. Hope. Let's think a bit about international cooperation. What has been done to deal with all of this? How do we do that? And here, my question from the beginning, number two, would be go out to those of you who are in my seminar and who have potentially read a bit about this, about Thomas Bernhauer's text on climate change politics. Is there anything, when reading about climate change politics, the history of international climate cooperation, that has surprised you? Is there anything you stumbled across and you thought like, ah, that's interesting or that's weird? Anyone? That's a good one. I don't have the slides with me on, so signing, I just jump in here and then I talk about all these issues one after one. And Frank's comment is a really interesting one and we have to discuss it a bit. I mean, it will come here and there and need to discuss that a bit later. One thing that surprised me, to be honest, I mean, we know about climate change even longer than it's on this timeline. What surprised me is how old climate change cooperation is. It's exactly as old as I am. Crazy, isn't it? And still, I mean, I fared much better than climate change. No. So, since 1979, we have this World Climate Conference. They already established in the late 1980s this Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which, by the way, is a cool invention. Because what this is it's not that they created, this is a panel which its duty is to put every now and then together a report that maps what the state of knowledge is at this point in time concerning both the causes and the consequences of climate change, with the intention to provide policymakers with the best knowledge available at this point in time for them to make the best informed decisions when negotiating. And they did that in a clever way. They didn't hire scientists. I mean, they pay scientists to do that stuff, but the scientists do not do extra research for the IPCC, but they collect what is there, take it, and really assemble this in this one huge, I mean, these reports are huge. And this is really a really interesting idea. It has become super politicized over the years. Now they fight for this, there's this summary for policymakers. They literally, countries fight over every word that is in this policy, or the summary for policymakers in order not to be bound later on when negotiating. I have a colleague in Glasgow, Patrick Bayer, who works, has a project exactly on this, where they really can show with using track changes which word came in what, and this is, yeah, as weird as it gets. Three things on international cooperation politics or treaty politics. One is that, as is true for most international environmental problems, countries start out with a so-called framework convention. This has happened in the early 1990s, the Earth Summit in Rio. And these framework conventions are typically signed and ratified by almost every country, simply because they don't contain any real obligations. They are really just stating the problem that we are there and an intention that we want to do something. Importantly, signing and ratifying is two different things. The US has signed the Kyoto Protocol, but they never ratified it. And Bill Clinton knew when they negotiated it that they would never ratify it. Why so? Because the US needs 2/3 of the Senate to pass to ratify any of these international binding agreements, and he knew already back then he would never get by that hurdle, which is a bit, I mean, I don't want to be kind to George Bush whatsoever, but he was always portrayed as the one not ratifying the Kyoto Protocol, while Bill Clinton would also have never been able to do that, but that's just a side note. Typically, these framework conventions are not really important. Important in the sense of they don't contain binding obligations. One part where the UNFCCC has become super important is that, as I said before, it contains the sentence on the common but differentiated responsibilities for countries. And this has later on made the bargaining about a follow-up protocol on the Kyoto really, really difficult. Why? Because it put the world in two baskets. Either you are responsible for the problem, mainly, you are an industrialized country, or you are not. And countries had no incentive, if they were in this basket, to say, hey, we move over to this one, because that meant we would have need to take on emission reduction obligations, which, of course, are costly. We don't want that. And this, it's not to say that, I mean, this is always a counterfactual. Had there not been such a statement in there, would the world have been different? I don't know. I don't think so. Maybe, we don't know. But this sentence was used as a justification again and again and again why we see certain outcomes. So, why did the Kyoto Protocol enter into force only so late? And this has been due to a provision that it needed to cover, back then I think it was 80%, I don't have the slide with the exact formulation, it was like a number of 20 countries and 80% of them, covering 80% of the emissions back then, before this thing would enter into force. And now you might think like, ah, that's stupid, why do we have that? Oh, in fact, it's not stupid at all. It's really important, because what you really want to avoid if you're negotiating such an agreement is that you negotiate an agreement that is costly for you, you ratify it, and then everyone else says, ha ha, good luck with this, you do that, we are out. But you really want to have a mechanism in there that says, okay, I ratify it, but I wait until enough others have ratified it too, and then we take on actions. As a safeguard, if someone steps back and says, oh, I changed my mind. So this has been a pretty sensible clause. It just took a while. Anyone has any idea what country was a tipping point? Russia. Why was Russia? Why had Russia any incentives of doing this? The same reason, I just have to jump in here. This was for that's for the European Union, the emission reduction targets under Kyoto. And you see something really interesting. You see something that you would expect, namely that countries such as Germany, Austria, Belgium have clear emission reduction targets. You also see something that specific other countries have emission reduction targets that are positive, and that's no error. That's they were allowed to emit more. Why? Because Greece, Portugal, Spain, their economies had not been at the same stage, they had argued, as Austria, Germany, and others. But then look at Hungary, Estonia, the Czech Republic, Croatia. Why do they have negative emission reduction targets if countries such as Greece and Portugal don't? Isn't that weird? For them, these were no hard targets, as it wasn't for Russia. Absolutely not. They just did that by shutting down so this is compared to 1990. So compared to the Soviet world, and how inefficient was this Soviet world, and just doing things, shutting down all these old companies and firms and production ways, just using newer technologies, easily done. That's politics. So that's really sometimes it's these interesting parts. So they just have no issues whatsoever doing this, which is also an interesting side note. So I just jump back to here. So Kyoto was this protocol where they said, hey, we have these common but differentiated responsibilities. We have these Annex I countries, these 37 industrialized countries, which had to cut their emissions, and the others didn't. The others were brought in with other mechanisms, such as the Clean Development Mechanism and joint implementation. And the idea was always that after the second period would be over, by the time this is over, they had the international community, the states, were able to negotiate an agreement that it's more encompassing. Encompassing in terms of emission reductions and encompassing in terms of countries who have to reduce emissions. They didn't succeed. Absolutely, completely failed. They tried long to get at this, but they had the US saying, oh, we don't want to join it. If at all, we join if India and China join. So they put the blame over there. China and India said, like, look at us. I mean, historically, responsibility, absolutely no way. First, you get your act together, then we might join, and so on and so forth. And we had this really blame game going on. No one wanted to do anything. And then they had really this issue of, do we want to have an agreement that it's in some sense very narrow in terms of covering some countries, mainly the European Union countries, doing it alone, hopefully maybe as a club later on getting it out, but really have clear emission reduction targets? Or do we opt for something entirely different? Something that brings everyone on board, gets finally rid of this common but differentiated responsibilities to some degree in order to bring everyone, give everyone responsibilities, of course, in different ways, have everyone be part of it, but get rid of the obligations. And that's Paris. They opted for this approach. Why is that Paris? Because the Paris Agreement has one goal. It says, we want to limit global warming to well below 2, preferably to 1.5 degrees Celsius compared to pre-industrialized levels. We don't get into a discussion whether this is still possible or not. To this end, worldwide emissions should peak as soon as possible. So that's the one goal. How do we get there? We ask every country to say themselves how we want to get there. We have these so-called, which we will see in a minute, nationally determined contributions. Countries submit them every 5 years. The only clear obligation is in there is that the next ones have to be more stringent than the previous ones. So there has to be a leveling up, ratcheting up. But whether this is any kind of meaningful, whatsoever. This is a bit as, for those guys who are in my seminar, I would ask you to define what you want to do to pass the seminar. It's up to you. No? And this is just to illustrate, I mean, this is just important for me that you see that in a world where we have in an international system with clear power structures, where we want to reach, in the best case, an agreement that solves a huge issue that is really hard to tackle, and in some sense we would need clear obligations to do stuff, but where we have the power structures, where we don't have an international government, at the end of the day we come up with something like the Paris Agreement that just says, okay, we acknowledge that we have a common goal, but apart from this, not really. And this is really important for me that you understand how weird it's so to say the Paris Agreement is, but also how, I mean, it's internet. I mean, this is always this thing about international politics. So international politics means we are faced with a system consisting of states that are endowed with very different power structures, and forcing a country to do something that it where it doesn't have any incentives. Good luck. Would there have been an alternative? And there's an economist that is called Scott Barrett, and he does really fantastic work. And he says, I mean, so the Kyoto Protocol back then was modeled after the so-called Montreal Protocol to save or to deal with the ozone depletion. And he said that was a big mistake. His better approach would have been to establish an international organization responsible for technological innovation and really invest, not telling countries, hey, you are only allowed to emit this and that, but rather take it from a completely different perspective, from a technological perspective, develop more innovation, do that stuff. Whether this would have been better, we don't find out, we never know, we don't have a second, we can't go back in time. That's where we are. We will see next week when we have the next COP, what happens then, whether anything good might come out. Very hard. I mean, in addition to the all these issues, how to move forward, one important issue that we will talk not exactly this, but a bit about in the presentation, is the issue of loss and damage. The idea that the global north owes the global south for the damage that happens there, that one needs to provide funds in order to compensate for the damage done and the losses done there. That will be one of the critical bargaining issues next week. We will see what comes out. As promised, just before it gets nicer with the cartoon, you might have understood that the idea of the NDCs, so these nationally determined contributions, so far doesn't work well. There's this global, this climate action tracker. They will have an, it's not that I was too lazy to update the November 2023 issue. It hasn't been out on Monday. I don't think it's out by now. What this NGO does is it collects all these NDCs and the policy pledges that are in there and tries to model then how much, if we did that, what would be the implications for the change in temperature. Ugh. And you see, it's not enough. Clearly not. Even the optimistic scenario, which has nothing to do with the pledges and targets we have so far, is above the 1.5 degree, but would be in line with the 2 degrees. Pledges and targets would be directly to 2. Current policies and action is 2.7, but that's last year, which hasn't figured in this extreme summer and the last extreme heating period, so I don't know what this means for the implications this year. We will see. So definitely not enough, but I have promised you something, and this is to maybe cheer you up a little bit. And this is one thing that I'm there, then I hand over to you, where I'm asked what these guys will talk in a minute about is a bit more the domestic politics about behind these nationally determined contributions. And these worry me at least as much, if not more, than the international dynamics, because what we see a lot is, I mean, if you have listened to the news this morning, we had a really bad, I mean, interesting elections in the Netherlands right now. And we see in many countries around the world that these right-wing populist parties use climate change and climate change politics as one way to mobilize people against this, and this is something that I find really worrying. And sometimes I think whether we just need to invest more in this, and by this I don't mean a cartoon, but with this I mean a vision of a world that would be so much better than the one we have, and really have a utopia, so to say, but one that works and really engages people and really shows them that we don't do that to annoy people and to take away their fire at home because we say them that they are no longer allowed to use fossil fuel heating, but that we really want to have a better world. But that's maybe a bit naive, but with 44 one is allowed to be a bit naive. At this point in time, I would just ask whether there are any questions on what I said.
I mean,
Yeah, yeah, but one positive argument could be it's engaging maybe, and it's bringing these actors in, and it's, it's absurd. What do you think? I mean, they've never been excluded. We can, and we don't have that much time to do this now, can think about the value of these COPs after all. We last year had a conference on climate change down in the Bodensee Forum, where we had exactly this discussion about, is there a value of these COPs at all? Is this not a big talking shop of countries making cheap talk and don't listen to that? I mean, don't do what they promised there. And if you look at all these voluntary things, all these voluntary pacts they have in addition to the Paris Agreement, and if you see what comes out of these, so far the result of those is really absolutely pessimistic, and then they just promise stuff. It's a bit of a greenwashing type of thing. At the same time, I'm totally with you. It's always good if involved actors talk, if they exchange views. A lot of the technological side of this means also that, I mean, actors learn about what is out there, what is possible to get heard, to get their voices heard, and so on. And from this perspective, one can say maybe it's still in some sense absurd that it's exactly in one of those countries that is among the highest emitters. I really hope that the US, but so far for the loss and damage part that I've talked previously, the European Union last week made the decision that they will go forward with this and that they have a clear commitment to this. The US is so much more careful on this because they are afraid that the way this could be worded could be read as a legal obligation to do stuff, and no way that in the current US political landscape this will go through. Still, it might be that there might be a weaker formulation of the loss and damage thing that where the US then also commits to money, but it's honestly unrealistic. This is hard for research to establish because A, they differ so much in what is, so we have these two COPs where there really is an agreement afterwards, like Kyoto and Paris, and a lot of those where there isn't. Is it among the responsibility or in the power even to say of the host to steer that off? Not really. There's some newer research that looks at whether it makes a difference for the local, the region where it's hosted, whether people become a bit more aware of the importance of it, and we see at least short-term effects of this, at least in democracies. And this is really, again, an important context factor for the current COP, which is definitely not in a democracy, where we have a media landscape around this, where, all these factors also will. There is some agenda setting power in the sense of they can push more topics here and there, and but this is overestimating on how much that is. Not really. This is an interesting question. There is some survey research on this there's a lot of survey research currently how you get people accept certain climate policies, and there is not much you can do. There are some who argue that if you in the US context really show this rivalry and say like, hey, China is getting ahead of us, we want to, that indeed nudges a few people. Even more interesting is, there's a study on Texas, which is super, so Texas is a super interesting case because Texas is, after California now, the state with the biggest renewable energy share in the US. And one reason why the Texans love renewables is because you can sell it to them on the autarky argument. It's like, hey, it makes you independent from those weirdos in Washington and from everyone else too. I mean, it's absurd that you need these kind of, but if it works, I mean, yeah. That's, so It's not that I don't want to discuss anything further with you, but we really, due to the sake of time, move over to the next presentation. First of all, thanks to everyone to listen to me so far. Anyone who wants to not listen to the presentation and is not in my seminar is free to go now. If you want to stay on, it will be super interesting. Thanks.